Okay, welcome back to the program. Good morning if you're after joining us. It's 7 minutes past 10 on this Wednesday, the 1st of February. Thank you so much for listening to the show and for calling and texting in. Here are some of your comments so far. Why can they not send someone out to check the people in the houses every 2 months, same as social welfare does their checking? I suppose they could just say, well, I wasn't in when you called. It would take multiple visits, and you could on multiple occasions you could argue that, you know, I was out doing this, or I was over visiting, or I was out on the farm, or whatever it might be. So I'm not sure that would achieve the goal. It would take an awful lot of manpower, let me put it like that, but I'm not quite sure it would fix the problem. Another caller says the council is correct regarding houses not being occupied. Letterkenny tenant worked abroad and rented the house to another family. Another well said Micheál Colum. Lots of you texting in on that. Different issues here too. The quickest way to get an NCT date is to ring up. I got mine within 10 days of ringing. Well, that's a systems failure though, isn't it? Because we're being pushed online and we trust that system. But as that listener says, ring them up. You're better off doing it that way. We closed our Ulster Bank accounts over 3 weeks ago. We're still waiting to see our money transferred to our new bank. We cannot contact Ulster Bank. Has any other listeners experienced this? I would be worried about that. It shouldn't take 3 weeks for the money to be transferred. And presumably you no longer have access to your Ulster Bank accounts to see if it's still there. Maybe that's an understandable period of time. Normally, for me, it was a working day. So 3 weeks I would see as troubling. But so can anyone out there help? This listener closed their Ulster Bank account 3 weeks ago, transferred their money into a new account, but the money has yet to arrive in the new account. Or maybe you have a contact number for the Ulster Bank that still works and they can chase it, it up there. Greg, listeners should be made aware of the enormous charges being made by ATM owners when withdrawing foreign currency. On Sunday last, I wanted to withdraw £10 sterling from an ATM in Strabane. I was astounded to find that £10 cost me €18.12. This extortionate rate should be illegal and the operators should be subject to some sort of regulation and control. I should point out that this ATM is not owned by any bank. It's a privately owned machine. Customers would be better off going to a bank or opt for cash back from a shop. I attach a photo of the transaction, which they did. I don't have it, but Caroline's looked over it. Needless to say, I cancelled the transaction. Wow. £10 costing €18.12 in Strabane. Would you ever have imagined that could be the case? Another caller says, there are so many older people living in bigger houses which they no longer need. I'm one of them. I've tried to get into sheltered accommodation because for me it would be company security and lesser bills. Can anyone point me in the right direction to do this? And you're not the first person that's contacted us on this matter. We had a couple of callers going back a couple of years ago now. Older people, as they described themselves, living in 4 or 5 bedroomed houses, they no longer needed and were hard for them to maintain. They wanted, and I think at the time they suggested maybe the council could work with them to take over their houses and to provide them with a 1 or 2 bed bungalow or a different type of accommodation, and they had no success in that regard either. Now, I'm not quite sure what sheltered accommodation is, but this listener is looking for that. Anyone got any advice in relation to that? Right, is this €50 Caroline mentioned, along with the 50 out of profits that the ESB feels sorry for us, and her Indo colleague Charlie Weston had said, it's criminal. They even increased the PSO levy that they didn't have to, but they did, as who's going to stop them? I don't know. That's from Kevin. I don't know if it's the same 50. This is an overcharge. I think it's a different one. A caller says 98 of combat fatalities are male. Timed armed forces adopt a policy of equal gender quotas for frontline troops, or do women only want that sort of equality in politics in the boardroom? And last one before we take a break. Greg, there is no crowd in this country as bad as Electric Ireland. In 10 years' time, someone like Caroline will uncover the complete scam that's taken place last year with regards to prices. I have a small business, and in one two-month bill, I have 3 different prices per unit, ranging from 31 cent to 66 cent. Now, it's challenging enough in business without having to deal with that. It seems to be, and I've said this before in this program, that your ESB bill can just be random. It can be a minefield. It can be guessed. Then you can send in the actual readings and it can go up, it can go down. we don't really know. You shop around, but you're told on the website, well, your bill this year is going to be $2,000. Switch here and it'll be 1,200. There's no real explanation. I find it really quite confusing. And certainly from a business perspective, to have three different unit prices on the one bill is really quite remarkable. A caller says, every planning permission for change of use is to people creating flats. Soon there'll be nothing left in the country but quick buck apartments. Is this really what we want for this county? Well, what do you want instead? We need accommodation. People have nowhere to live. But tell us a bit more to your comment there. How many government scandals we have seen now that Leo Varadkar knew nothing about? We are all fools, believes that listener. Okie dokie, very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Me and Patricia McBride talking about something completely different there. Patricia, of course, director of Hungarian on Theatre. Welcome to the programme. Good morning to you.
Thank you, Greg. Nice to see you.
You too. And we're talking about exciting times at Hungarian on Theatre in Letterkenny. $500,000. Is that right? Being spent, would you call it a facelift or an improvement or improvement works? Or how would you describe it?
Well, improvement. It's $600,000, actually. We got nice. $300,000 from the Department of Arts, and that is being matched by the Donegal County Council. So it's, you know, the building is nearly 25 years old, and one of the things that we have needed over the years is a workshop space, somewhere for rehearsals and somewhere for intimate performances. So this is an improvement to the building, as well as a refurbishment, I guess, because what we'll be doing is we'll be repurposing the upper foyer to make a studio space there, and that requires... Anybody that's familiar with the building will know that there are like three big voids in the first floor, two in the window and one...
like unused space?
Unused space, yeah. Okay. So the voids were originally for a public art commission, which never fully materialised. And so the benefits that we'll get from filling those in, and that makes it sound like very simple. I mean, you know, we don't have a full design solution yet, but when that area is filled in, we'll have much more floor space in the upper foyer. We'll create a workshop space, stroke intimate studio. But the benefits we'll get also is that we will have a much more energy efficient building. You know, the amount of heat that's lost through those voids at present is problematic.
And as you say, 20 years ago things were very different, perhaps. You know, we went maybe for the aesthetics rather than the practicality of things at times.
Well absolutely. And one of the other key elements of the refurbishment is an improvement is that we will redesign our box office. As you said, standards, you know, 20 odd years ago were different, and currently our box office and reception counter doesn't meet access standards for people who are wheelchair users, for example. It's very high. So, I mean, sadly, like the late Frank Larkin helped us prepare the application, and when he was sitting in his wheelchair at the counter, you literally couldn't see him, you know, from the seated position behind.
So in a way, too, he will have influence on what is to part of his legacy, really.
We'll absolutely. Frank helped us with that.
Which I think is nice, actually.
It'll be lovely to see it come into fruition,
sure.
Because not only will it be a better space for customers, but the new design will allow us to actually employ someone who potentially who is a wheelchair user.
And this area upstairs that will be created, that you'll create the workshop from, just kind of interested because I'm not really, because I'm learning as much as anything. Smaller scale performances as well, you describe them as intimate performances. So is that sort of maybe a one or two person and you could have a group of people standing around watching them? Is that
Yes, that's the idea.
Okay, that'd be nice.
I mean, I think it'll be used for workshops and rehearsals. I mean, our own youth theatre need a space to work. But a lot of community groups are looking for spaces. It's something that, you know, in terms of what's available throughout the town, there is a shortage of spaces for classes and workshops. So, we do a lot of development work. So, for example, if we were doing a play reading of a new play, then we have potential, what our brief states is that we would like to have seating capacity for around 50 to 60 people for that kind of thing. So, you know, so it would be a very low tech, maybe poetry readings, very intimate, you know, music recital, that type of thing.
But more flexibility.
Yes.
The space to be used when it currently can't be really used effectively.
Yes, exactly.
And also, I read also proposals for a continental-style dining area.
Yes, I mean, it's kind of fortuitous. The two things are on track at the same time. But yeah, there's the eat-out, outdoor dining space, which will be a redevelopment of our outdoor plaza. And that's being led by the County Council. That is something that was funded by the Tourist Board, and again, with match funding from the County Council. So that the idea there is to create a more, as you say, continental, you know, forget the weather.
I know, how do we describe it? I know what you mean, yeah.
But it's...
you can eat outside.
You know, where the theatre is, on the Lower Port Road there are a lot of takeaway places. So it's to provide a facility for people to get their takeaway and come and sit in a nice surrounding.
And you know what? We get a few decent days, and it's quite sheltered up there as well. Do you know what I mean?
It is, absolutely. And the design concept for that is being finalised at present. But we'll also incorporate the ability to do outdoor performances there. So there are plans to have like a raised area, you know, kind of like a stage. So we've seen concepts, but the detailed designs are happening
now. I get the feeling you just really want to move on with this as quickly as is possible, without compromising anything in the process either. Now the €600,000, that's not how much you're looking for someone to bid for this work either, I presume. You want estimates, you want designs, and then that can be adjusted up and down if necessary.
I mean, it's a public tender process, so we have put that in as the absolute maximum budget available. That deadline for submissions is the 7th of February.
Has there been a good interest?
There have been expressions of interest through the eTenders webpage.
Good. Okay.
So hopefully we'll get some good bids.
Yeah. On. And in terms of planning, you know, I mean, a lot of this is internal works. When you get the right crew for the job, it can be progressed quite quickly, can it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because the work internally is refurbishment. Mm. And it isn't really encroaching on any new space or anything, so we don't actually need the full planning for that.
Brilliant.
Planning has already been approved for the outdoor space, so that's all
moving
on. Shovel
ready, I think they call this
yes,
type of project.
Yes, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Do you hope to have it done this year?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Great.
I mean, I know there's a lot of talk about the cost of construction and the difficulty of getting builders and all of that, but we're aiming to have it all done, both things done in tandem this year.
Great.
I mean, at the end of the day, it's an enhancement of a community resource, and you know, it'll make the theatre better. It'll, you know, it'll energise that Lower Port Road area as well.
It's hard to believe it's 20 years old, because you know, looking at the building, it's from a design perspective externally stood the test of time well, hasn't it? It doesn't look out of place if it were built last month.
No, I think, you know, it was a very modern design at the time. Actually, Greg, it's 25 years next year. We'll be celebrating our anniversary in 2024. So, yeah.
That's kind of exciting.
It really has stood the test of time well.
Yeah, I think so.
But like all buildings need to be, you know, attended to and things break
down.
But
it's not just the physical that gets a rejuvenation. You know, it's the staff, it's the management, and then, of course, it allows a new breath of life through the building too, with this new space upstairs.
Well, yeah, it'll allow us to do different kinds of programming from what we do currently. I mean, we do development work, we do small scale performances, but a 383 seat auditorium can be quite unforgiving for that kind of work, so it'll be fantastic to put that in a proper space. And you know, it will be a boost for staff as well, because these are projects that we've been talking about for a long time. We actually got the funding for the internal works in 2020. So given the pandemic, things have been very delayed. So we're really keen to get on with it and get it done this year.
All right, excellent stuff. And anything good coming up? soon?
Yeah.
There's always something good coming up. It's just to set you up for a plug, really.
You're asking the wrong person if you want me to say anything different. We got a great weekend, actually, with three events in a row, all pretty much sold out this weekend. But, yeah, we've got a great programme of comedy coming up. Neil Delamere this weekend, Dermot Whelan. There's a handful of tickets left for Dermot. We've got Colin Murphy, Jared Farrelly, Tommy Tiernan, already sold out, but we've got some brilliant drama as well. We've got The Abbey coming back to us with a new play by Molière and an adaptation by Frank McGuinness and directed by Katrina McLaughlin. So great Donegal connections with that project. But we've got Druid coming up very soon. They have an award-winning show called The Last Return, which got like 5-star reviews when it ran in the Dublin Theatre Festival and the Edinburgh Festival last year. And then we've got a lovely little play called Dante Dan, and it's a coming-of-age story set in the 1970s down in Cork.
We're speaking to one of the actors in that, and there's a connections too to the Banshee of
Inisherin.
What do we call it? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
The other
great thing is Frank Kinavan is coming back with his new play called King.
Yeah.
You know, people will know his plays Silent and Forgotten.
People like to perform there. It must have a good reputation. You know, obviously there's a commercial element to anything.
Well, yeah,
because it's a great venue in the Northwest. But it seems people like to go back to On Green On. They always talk of those that I interview that are coming back again. They genuinely seem to look forward to coming back and playing in that environment.
Well, the theatre itself is a beautiful physical space with a great sort of relationship between the stage and the auditorium. But actually, everybody raves about Donegal audiences as some of the warmest in the country. And, you know, I think it's a credit to the whole community that people like to come back to the theatre.
And I still think I often say it, but, you know, I think we're very lucky, even though I'm not exactly beaten a path because for different reasons, babies and things. I wouldn't get as much as I would probably like to. But we're lucky in that we have a facility that brings acts and performances that you would travel to Belfast or somewhere else to see, or even up to Derry, but you know, or down to Dublin or whatever, that they're brought closer to us. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I think really that's really quite important because it gives people access to the arts without having to travel great distances in many cases.
Yeah, and I mean we offer a diverse programme with comedy, music, dance, drama, you know, and there's so much local community work as well from the amateur companies. And like, what's really lovely this year is seeing all the schools back in the variety concerts. And we had an event just before Christmas called Constellations, which was a kind of a celebration of all the local talent. And it was great to see so many groups participating in that.
And what's the story in terms of plans for the quarter century birthday? Are you going to go to town on that or still working on it or what?
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely still working on it because at the minute I'm just trying to balance the programme against when the capital works might actually happen. I think we'll be thinking about it and planning, but certainly not announcing anything for a while.
Well, you could have worse problems to worry about, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
You know, your programme and development and
yes.
stuff, it's great. Okay, listen, thanks so much for calling in. And you don't really have an idea at this point when works might start, but you'll let us know and we'll let the listeners know.
We'll let you know. If everything goes to plan, we'll have a clear idea once we get the tenders in.
Excellent.
In early February.
All right, lovely stuff. Thank you. That's Patricia McBride, Director of On Green On Theatre in Letterkenny. Okay, you're welcome back to the programme. Now, as we were reading, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar yesterday said he must have been aware of a government plan to curb payment to families who were overcharged for nursing home care. And he doubled down on his defence amid an outcry yesterday as he said medical card holders were not entitled to free nursing home care. I mean, that's obviously a significant scandal playing out in and of itself. But Pat O'Connor, policy specialist with Age Action, this is maybe a symptom, really, of our attitude and treatment to older generations. Is it that this would be seen as, and we don't know exactly what is to come, but that it would be seen as some way acceptable?
Well, this is a long-running saga, unfortunately. I mean, it starts in 1970 with the Health Act, which states quite clearly that someone with a medical card was entitled to free-of-charge nursing home care in public beds. And what happened from 1970 is that people despite having a medical card, were charged. So this is known, unfortunately, this is a scandal that went on for decades. Various court rulings ruled that this was illegal. It was known to be illegal within the department. And that saga continued all the way up to the 2000s, where there was a redress scheme, but it was quite narrow in its remit. And about 480 million was paid out to about 20,000 families affected. But it's clear that there was a couple of hundred thousand other people affected by this over the decades who were in some way illegally charged for nursing home care. And the scandal here is really that this was known to the department. They had legal advice, there were court judgments, but that what was revealed last weekend is that there was a top secret legal strategy to frustrate this ever coming to court. And so what ministers have said in recent days, quite accurately, is that, you know, the state has never admitted that this people were entitled to free of charge care, but that's because it never got to court, because there were lots of settlements before court or before documents would be disclosed. So as a result, we've never had that sort of final legal clarity. And the net result is that many people paid for nursing home care and you know, had to perhaps sell their home or farm.
Well, that's it, because you've outlined it perfectly there as to what went on. But the impact it had on families, ironically, in a way, the person who needed the care was getting the care. But as you say, those around them, partners, husbands, wives, children, to provide that care that they received, they, in some cases, lost everything that they had earned, or, you know, that the person in care or the partner, that everything they had accumulated their entire life had to be liquidated to pay for this care, care that they should have been receiving for free. I mean, the consequences
absolutely
are huge.
That's exactly it. And the Ombudsman wrote a report in 2010 with the rather apt title of "Who Cares?" And it detailed cases of individuals. So, for example, you could have a couple where one has gone into nursing home care and the spouse handed over most of their pension, and people were living on, what, today, 30, 40 euro a week, because all of the rest of the resources were being paid to afford nursing home care. In other cases, not only the person or the couple was assessed, but the wider family's means were assessed, and they were all to contribute money to pay for nursing home care. And this was happening outside of the legal structures. And that's the key thing. Now, the nursing home support scheme, the so-called Fair Deal scheme, comes in 2009, and it provides for a legal regime. But the net issue here is from 1970 through to 2009, these were unlawful charges, or at least there was a lot of legal questions that have never been satisfactorily answered. And many tens of thousands of families, you know, suffered privation, in some cases poverty, because they were paying for things. Whereas if somebody had legal advice, because they had the wherewithal to fight these charges, they weren't charged, sometimes for the sort of the same kind of bed as the person beside them. And that's, you know, the inequality or the injustice as part of this.
And just to imagine someone in care who them themselves had worked really, really hard to leave something to their children, and then for them to be aware that that, as I say, had to be liquidated or sold or lost effectively to pay for their care. Just how that, in some cases, perhaps their last months or years of their lives, the emotional impact that would have on someone at their end, you know, towards the end of their life. It's horrendous. And I think this needs to be out in the open. You know, we don't need cloak and dagger language, or I must have been told about it, but I don't remember being told about it. It's, do you know, I think this just needs to be a very open and honest, all cards on the table type of conversation going forward. I think people deserve that.
Absolutely. I mean, we've had these reports before. 2005, we had the Travers report, which looked at the whole system. We, as I said, the Ombudsman report. And it what we need is absolute clarity. And we need a process that people can have confidence in, that it's not just about who knew what and when, but it's that people can have confidence that there is a regime in place that is fair, that is balanced, and that, you know, is going to provide care for people. And yes, under the Fair Deal scheme, we have to pay for care. It's expensive. But that there's a fair system, and there's a cap put on how much you have to pay. And that for people who were affected in the past, if there was an injustice, there needs to be some kind of remedy. not necessarily a colossal compensation scheme, but recognition that it was wrong and a remedy put in place. So
the problem with that, though, Nat, is that, and listen, what you're saying is correct, but what is required for that to happen is either people currently making decisions and some in different positions now that were in position in the early noughties, for example, to admit that they were complicit in this, or to suggest that they simply have no recollection of ever being told about it. That one of those two things has to happen before we arrive at a position whereby there is some sort of a redress. And I just see this process being frustrated to ensure that doesn't happen, because I can't historically remember where, you know, current decision makers were to put their hands up and say, look, we were part of this. It was wrong. We got it wrong. But now what we're going to do is provide such and such.
Well, I mean, there have been those moments, and you're right, we need it again, because it's exactly as you say, either the ministers knew and signed off on it, or else they did not know. And so you have to ask, why did senior officials not inform their ministers? And 2005 Travers report makes that point, that it does seem that officials withheld information from ministers or didn't fully brief them, or briefed them in a very scant way where things were brushed over, rather than the enormity of the decision being fully brought to the attention of the minister. And likewise, health officials in the past have briefed the advisor to the minister on the assumption that the minister would be briefed, but in the slew of information that always didn't happen. So there was a breakdown in the kind of the basic duty that ministers should be informed of these key decisions. And that's a governance issue that at the heart of the decision making.
But then there's all the nuances to this as well, because, you know, there are references to people saying this is a good strategy, it's working well, keep at it. There's an awful lot there. And I just can't imagine me sitting here and someone coming up to me and saying, by the way, we have a strategy, you know, just running this past you briefly, whereby, you know, we are frustrating people to the point whereby we know we owe them the money, but because they may not have the money to pursue this, they're not pursuing it. But if they do have the money to pursue it and we have to tell them what we know, well, then we're going to settle with them on the QT. I can't imagine me sitting here going, right, okay, keep at it, and then forgetting that conversation ever took place, because it's really, really quite significant. And we're talking billions here, and we know how we're reminded of the cost of the Mike redress scheme, for example, being far short of what this might have cost. I find it hard to believe that someone could be briefed on that and forget that.
Well, that's just it. And over the decades, advice was given again and again that if we settle this now, we will limit the future costs. But if we let this run, there's the risk of compensation or liability. Even as early as 1975, there was a sense that the 1970 Health Act was deficient in some way, needed to be reformed. Now, because, you know, you could make an argument that the state simply couldn't afford to provide nursing home care free of charge to everybody. That's a reasonable argument. And so we have to find the right way to pay for the thing. But instead of passing a law to bring that in, the issue was fudged. There was no law, but instead you had, for example, a 1976 circular that took people's medical cards away from them so that they could be charged. Once you went into the residential care, you would be deemed ineligible for the medical card, and therefore you could be charged for your care. So these sort of administrative rules, which were unlawful, they went outside the legal powers of the officials involved, and yet they persisted for decades. And so we eventually got there, but it was 2009 before we had the Fair Deal scheme in law. So that's the issue, is that nobody grasped the nettle for decades.
Yeah.
And it you know, that's the scandal, or a large part of the scandal.
And this is a tried and tested strategy, seemingly, because RTE revealed last night that the state denied up to 12,000 vulnerable people their disability allowance payments, and the same strategy, bar the shouting, was employed to limit the liability to the state. Nat, from Age Action's perspective, what needs to happen, I suppose, going forward? I mean, we're not going to sort out retrospectively here at this point, but going forward, what needs to happen to ensure that our older persons and their families aren't subjected to this type of, you know, do we need an extra layer of oversight here? And if so, what form might that take?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that we have proposed. One is a commissioner for ageing and older persons. We've had a children's ombudsman since 2004. We've had a full minister for children, but we don't have that for older persons. We have a minister of state for older person services and mental health, but it's not quite the same thing as minister for ageing across all government departments. But if we had an independent commissioner, that would be an office that people could go to seek investigations, for research to be done, and an independent office that would have that all of government remit. So that's really missing. There is one in Northern Ireland, there's one in Wales, and there's good evidence there that how they have worked, you know, effectively to defend the rights of older persons. So that's important. And the other thing we need to see completed is the state's long-term care strategy. We have a success story of an aging population. Most older persons are in good health, but you know, we're going to double the number of people aged 80 and older in just 12 years. So we do need to plan for home care, for nursing home care, and for other forms of care. And that we're promised a commission on care, which, you know, it seems it's in the programme for government, but that hasn't happened yet. So it's really important we see progress on that, and that we see a care policy joined up that's going to guarantee all of us that if, you know, in older age, we're in a situation where we can't care for ourselves and not everybody has family, for example, to step in, that there is a plan that is funded, that is transparent and fair, that how we will be looked after after we've all made our contribution to society.
That would be agreeable to older people as well, too, because some of the options sometimes are, well, it's like that or nothing, and the like that is not what people want. I mean, it's going to, I think a lot of the problem, not in this country, but in other countries, and this isn't a conspiracy theory, it's fact, is that we can legislate and plan and what have you, but unfortunately with slowing birth rates, there is a tipping point down the line whereby we have an older population and much fewer younger people to either fund through taxes or actually provide the care that's required. But I think that's a few years away. But I wonder if it's at the back or front of government's minds around the country. We've seen in Japan, for example, they believe they're right at the verge of a crisis in that regard. But anyway, as I say, I don't think me and you are going to sort that out today. Listen, thanks very much for your time, Nat. I really do appreciate it. Have a lovely day, and we appreciate you helping us highlight these issues.
Thanks very much indeed.
All right, bye-bye. Nat O'Connor, Policy Specialist with Age Action, 08660 25000 is the WhatsApp and text line for you there. Tony Grant is community activist, and he's going to speak to us now about plans for the Tourist Visitor Centre at Dunree. It's expected to open in April 2026. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. Hi.
Thank you for joining us. Are you amongst those who have concerns about this development? And if so, tell us a bit about them.
Yeah, I certainly have. You know, the proposed investment of 12 million for Dunree, the development in Dunree, is welcome. But it's welcome, but, you know, there's always a but. But the money should be used wisely. And tastefully, and you know, nothing should be suffer as a result. It should be a plus. It should be an addition. There should be no losses here. You know, and that's what I'm saying.
What are your what's your main concern about the plans?
Well, the main concern is that it was floated in the media now that they're proposing to install this high-tech funicular vehicle that people would be attracted to the area from all over Europe, they believe, and they would come for this joyride in a glass cube that would take them up the hill to the top of Dunree Hill and to view the views of the surrounding areas, yes, and then that they would come down again and it wouldn't stop, it would go right over the water, and there would be a wow factor there and a fear, and they would all get excited about it. It'd be a huge exciting thing. This is supposed to be you know, something that people couldn't resist, you know, and they would have to come and experience it.
I don't mean it funny, Tony, but it sounds fantastic. You've sold me. and as I say, I'm not being facetious there, but it sounds brilliant. So what's the problem?
Indeed, you see, but it's the wrong place. You know, Dunree Fort is a unique piece of property. It's got a unique history. It's got a unique location. And it should be respected for that. And you know, to have turn it into a theme park is ridiculous.
I think it's a slight overreach to call it a theme park, though, isn't it, though, Tony? I mean, the way you describe it in terms of it going out over the seas, it's not going to be flying. You know, people aren't going to be strapped in. It's slow moving. No. It affords people a view of our coastline that would ordinarily be hard to see. And what's really important to me, or what I think might be really important in this, is access that people of all abilities in terms of moving around, whether they're wheelchair bound or whatever, would all be able to go up and experience the wonder of Dunree at the top of the hill as you've described it, that everyone would be able to see it, that we all could enjoy regardless of our ability to walk or what have you.
Yeah, on the surface, Greg, now that sounds reasonable, you know. But, you know, this is they're already searching Europe to get the best machine to do this job. It hasn't been decided yet. And they're still doing market research. Bord Fáilte, as they said, they hasn't finally decided. But I'm just putting a word of caution and warning here that we live in remote Ireland here in Dunree and Inishowen, and very high skills are going to be required to operate this high-tech machine. And, you know, it's going to be an enclosed glass cube and with wheelchairs in it, yes, as you said. And if that breaks down, what about the safe evacuation of trapped passengers from the lift? And it is really a lift. It's like a lift.
But Tony, I understand exactly, and where you're coming from, Tony, and you're making very strong arguments. But I suspect that your core objection to this would not be necessarily if it broke down and how you deal with that. Like, is it? Are you concerned about the track? Are you concerned about the track going up and down the hill? Are you concerned at the visual element of this box?
No, I don't want you to keep. I have to say, it is my. I am concerned because I've worked in this industry for 40 years, and I know it like the back of my hand, and that's my concern is that we're installing a machine that might just become a white elephant in Dunree, because if it breaks down and we have to import the skills to fix it every time, it'll be out of order for a week before it's fixed. And that's not exaggerating now, Greg. Yeah. And also, the cost of insurance, a comprehensive insurance and policy there for the comprehensive maintenance contract, which will be mandatory by the insurance company. This is all going to, I am estimating here, right? Mm-hmm. I am estimating that would cost $100,000 a year to operate, to work. And my other concern is once you've got installed that thing, that's just the thin end of the wedge. People will be looking for other experiences and exciting things to do there, swinging out of ropes and all sorts of things, which will be destroy what we have in Dunree as a military. It was a military, and it's not military anymore, but it's an interpretive centre. It's got. I would love to put forward, and if just if you could bear with me for make it very brief, that there's something that would be far more valuable, and also return on investment would be more if we turned that into some sort of a marine institute. It's right on the water. And we've got a new Atlantic Technical University in Letterkenny, and we could award degrees through this, and people could have good jobs going forward, and we could restore the huts in Dunree, and we could have them as workshops and classrooms, and we could, then we would attract people all over Europe, because we have the, in the next 5 years, Europe is going to designate more of Lough Swilly as a marine protected area. And here would be a fantastic hub to capitalize on that and to bring wealth to the area instead of a white elephant.
And this is why we're in this consultation process, and it seems the likes of Fulcher Ireland and others are very open to hearing your views, Tony, and the view of others as well. Because, yes. I mean, obviously, no development's going to be a 100% satisfactory to everyone, but it's important, and I think it's good to see that they seem keen to engage with the likes of yourself to get your views and draw on your experiences.
Yes, I agree. But can I say that people contacted me after the meeting that I don't know, never met, and they phoned because my phone number was I handed it out, and that they are upset because they are military families. Over 30 military families came to Buncrana and the environs around Inishowen, and their families came here from other parts of Ireland. And over 30 we can count at the moment, and maybe there are more. And they feel they are just being brushed aside. And there could be possibly be an entrance fee to this, and this with this, and people now go into the moment and they walk around, they go up the hill, and they have great freedom, and it's a wonderful place to visit. I recommend anybody.
Could you would you be happy with a balance if locals who traditionally use it for walking and other recreational activities maybe had free access, but visitors, tourists were charged? Could you see a business case for that?
It's going to be very difficult to do, Greg, because it's a right of way. Mm. It's a right of way thing, Henry, if I'm not mistaken, because cattle used to be driven through there even when it was used by the army.
Yeah.
And you know, people I have asked them, would they be willing to have their stories written down now, because they are now they're excited in the wrong way, in a negative way, by what they think is going to happen here, and they feel that they're being disregarded and disrespected.
And part of your concerns, Tony, as well, that you believe the history of this site is being disregarded or disrespected, in that, you know, I mean, those making the trek at the moment perhaps have an interest in military and history, but what we might actually see is the majority of visitors are just going along for the ride, that really what is at the top of the hill doesn't really interest them in the slightest. Is that part of it, that maybe in some way it's even maybe disrespectful to the history of Dunree?
Just running roughshod over the history of the fort. I do agree, but I suggested to met Donegal County Council representative there the other night, and the Board Fáilte, and as you said, they were very receptive to sat down at a table and were very receptive to listening. And I suggested to them, and they agreed with me, that what we need in Donegal County Council is an environmentalist at the top decision-making position, so that things are done tastefully and that the environment is respected. And this is not happening. And I said, we need this in every Donegal County Council in Ireland. Every council in Ireland needs this. I'm not annoyed anymore when I see Donegal do things, because I told them this the other night. I said, because I see that's your level of consciousness. You can't do any better because you're not aware of a better way of doing things. You're still pouring mass concrete into things far too readily. And an example of that was Swan Park. Far too much concrete. And everybody knows that now recently. That is the one thing. All they say, it is very nice, it is very nice, it is very nice, but there's far too much concrete.
All right, caller says, I'm with Tony on this one. Far too much money being spent in Dunree, and so many people homeless and struggling with this announcement. Just don't think it's right. Now, I'm not sure you're making the latter point to that, but they're certainly agreeing with you in terms of the initial spend. Tony, thanks for your time. I hope you feel you've had your views well aired.
Well, thank you, Greg.
Okay, that's thank good. You. As long as you feel you've got your voice. Okay, thanks so much indeed, Tony. Tony Grant there, a community activist in that area. What do you think? 086-6025000, 086-6025000. Time to quickly mention our Community Hero initiative that we are working with iMotors on in relation to this. And it's really quite simple. We're inviting you to nominate a community hero, someone you see as a hero in your community that has been of a great assistance to you. They might work for an organisation. Maybe you're an organisation that wants to nominate them. The winner will receive access to a 231 Nissan Qashqai for 12 months, a brand new, beautiful car from iMotors for 12 months. So if you have someone in mind, and I'm sure someone popped into your head, that you think that this would be a lift for them, maybe they don't have a very reliable vehicle at the moment, or maybe they don't have a vehicle at all, and they would get benefit from this vehicle, please give us their name and jot down a few details. You don't have to write an essay. Send it to comments@highlandradio.com or write it down and post it to Highland Radio Mountaintop Letterkenny or drop it in to us. And the lines close, or the draw closes, or the competition, it's not really a competition, but it closes anyway. Entries close on the 22nd of February, and then we'll announce the winner on this programme on the 24th. So I think it's a lovely thing, and I think it's really generous as well. Access to a brand new, beautiful Nissan Qashqai for your community hero. Get your nominations in.